Support for WPR comes from the American Society of Landscape Architects Wisconsin Chapter. Dedicated to reimagining the design of outdoor spaces for the well-being of all. Examples at wiasla.com. Support for WPR comes from Milwaukee Film, presenting the 16th Annual Milwaukee Film Festival, featuring local, national, and international films, April 11th through the 25th. Tickets are at mkefilm.org.
So I was thinking, Jonathan, for people who love exploring other cultures, one of the most visceral ways to do that, of course, is to eat. And even if you can't afford plane fare, many of us who are lucky enough to live in medium or large cities can kind of take a little trip to another country just by hitting the right restaurant. But I think that maybe most of the time the food that we're eating has actually been subtly translated for North American appetites. Would you agree?
Of course it has, or at least in most of the country it has. I know in Madison, for example, and they have some Laotian restaurants that are fine, they're decent. But Laos is a poor country, and it has a sort of cuisine of poverty. You know, they eat every leaf and every sort of herb and tiny scraps of meat because they can't afford more. And it's a specific kind of, bitterness and of spiciness and of sort of herbaceous quality, because that's what they can eat and that's what they can afford to eat. And so if they've, say, transplanted themselves to Madison in the middle of American abundance into a landscape where people perhaps can't tolerate, bitter and spicy and herbaceous flavors like that, of course the flavors are going to change. But if Laos had looked like Wisconsin to begin with, maybe the food would have always been that way.
Hmm. What about, you live in L.A., a city with a huge and varied immigrant population, not to mention an enormous restaurant community. Do you find in a city like L.A. there's less of that translation going on?
I think there is. The reason L.A. is different from most cities in the country, I think, or maybe any city, is that, A, it's very spread out. B, we have enormous immigration. So, Los Angeles has more Salvadorans than any city but San Salvador. We would be the second largest city in Mexico. There are more Mexicans living here than there are even in Guadalajara. There are more Koreans living here than there are anywhere outside of Korea. And the communities are large enough and the spaces are large enough and the neighborhoods are insular enough that I find that a lot of those people in a lot of those restaurants are cooking for themselves rather than cooking for the non-Korean or the non-Mexican that might be walking through the doors.
And how different does that make the food then?
It makes a huge difference, I think. In New York City, for example, which also has huge immigration, say you have a Korean restaurant that's in a Korean neighborhood, like out on Northern Boulevard in Flushing. They're mostly cooking for Koreans, but still they take the subway every day like everybody else. They take the buses, they go into Manhattan. They're always rubbing shoulders with people who aren't Korean. And as a result, they're probably thinking a lot harder about what non-Koreans might like to eat. Whereas here, they don't. So I think the seasonings are direct and the cooking methods are direct. And Mr. Kim goes into a restaurant, he wants to eat exactly what he ate, what his mother used to make him on Thursday afternoons when he was growing up, and he's able to find that. And we're able to go into those restaurants and eat what Mr. Kim is eating. And I don't think that's necessarily possible.
Mm. Yeah, there's this notion sometimes when you go to a restaurant, it's typically an Asian restaurant, and there's this untranslated part of the menu. And I've always thought that those are the real dishes, the authentic dishes. Is that what you order?
Sometimes I try to. I mean, sometimes the dishes on the wall are not necessarily things that you would like. I mean, it could just as well be sweet and sour chicken as anything else. if there isn't sweet and sour chicken on the menu. Just because it's on the wall doesn't mean that it's special. But a lot of times, especially in non-Chinese restaurants, I think, the things that are on the wall, the things that are non-translated, tend to be the dishes that people are making for themselves. And yeah, it is always fun to try to figure out what those are.
So
a lot of time.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I spent a lot of time going to friends who have some knowledge of Thai or have some knowledge of Khmer and getting them to translate pages of menus and then going back and ordering off of the translated menu. It's fun.
Hmm. Of course, for those of us who, you know, if you haven't been to Khmer or you haven't been to Bangkok, how would you have any idea whether what you're eating is a North Americanized version of Thai food or the real deal?
Well, in one way, you can't. But in another way, there's this directness of flavor that tends to come from extreme regionality. For example, you're talking about Thai dishes, and Thais use a lot of organ meats that don't necessarily make it onto the, you know, the mall Thai restaurants. They use a lot of fish sauce, and they use a lot of fermented fish and shrimp paste, which give things sort of a very strong, funky, armpity smell. They're big on not just the regular herbs that we know about, but or the minty kinds of herbs, but a lot of bitterness. And there's sort of a strength of flavor that makes something really, truly Thai. That being said, there's an extremely legitimate school of Thai cooking that's sort of palace Thai cooking, which uses a lot of coconut milk and which is not necessarily super spicy and which is possible. But I don't think there are a lot of restaurants in the United States that are capable of cooking that kind of food well.
What do you think are the kind of the most egregious sorts of mistranslations of food, that ethnic food that you find in North America? I mean, food that's kind of been dumbed down, essentially. I mean, I think of, I don't know, that gloppy marinara sauce you find in Italian-American restaurants, but you've probably got your own list.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the Olive Garden, but in a way, Americanization of foreign foods is legitimate in its own way. I mean, cuisine is never stable. It's never fixed. It's always changing. It's impossible to think of Italian food without thinking of tomato sauce, for example. But tomatoes weren't really used that much in Italy until the 19th century. That it's almost impossible to think of, say, Thai cooking or Sichuan cooking without thinking of chilies. But, of course, chilies are also from the West, part of the Colombian exchange, and they didn't make it to those countries until, you know, the 18th or 19th century. And the ideas of what are authentic are always changing. That being said, it's still horrifying to come across Tex-Mex queso, I guess. But
or really, I mean, walk through the frozen food section of just about any grocery store and, you know, aisles of packaged egg rolls and teriyaki chicken and prepackaged burritos. And, well, as you said, it's all the Americanized versions of things.
Well, yeah, it can get pretty horrific. And although in a way I suppose Taco Bell is legitimate for what it is, it's not legitimate for anything I particularly want to eat.
Of course, I mean, we're sort of assuming in this maybe kind of snobbish way that Americanized food automatically means it's, you know, it's not as good. It's not the authentic, real thing. It's inferior. It's been dumbed down. But sometimes, surely, an Americanized version of something actually takes on a life of its own and becomes good.
No, of course, things are authentic to regions. I mean, one of the things that I write about a lot is Mexican food in Southern California. And, you know, of course, Southern California used to be Mexico. And I mean, a long time ago, but it was. And we've always had like a substantial, you know, Spanish American or Mexican American or plain Mexican community. And there are the sort of foods that people describe eating in the ranchos in the 19th century that you can still go into some restaurants here and find, you know, the beans cooked a certain way, the, you know, the marinated and grilled meats, the chicharrones, the salads with nopales, the roasted cactus. And there's a well-developed sort of Chicano cuisine or Mexican-American cuisine that's great. And everybody's, you know, grandmothers and great-grandmothers and great-great-grandmothers, like, cooked this food, and it's what people grew up on. And then there's the second set of immigration that started, I guess, after the Immigration Act of 1965, where it's much more recent, and people are coming from, I mean, it sounds weird to say from specific places, but they identify with their, you know, their village in Michoacán or coming from Guadalajara or coming from Zacatecas or coming from Oaxaca or coming from Colima more than they do coming from Mexico. I mean, Mexico is a place where civic identity changes every 20 miles. And it is possible to go to a place and have absolutely the same kind of like birria, which is like a roast goat with consomme, that you would have in downtown Guadalajara. You know, same kind of people cooking it, same people eating it. The goat is cooked the same. The seasonings are the same. You could close your eyes and you would not be able to tell the difference between the one from Guadalajara and the one from, you know, downtown LA. But because there is this sort of quote-unquote authentic or more specifically regional food that a lot of people who are sort of in the second stage of Los Angeles connoisseurship tend to dismiss the older places as inauthentic. And in fact, they are authentic. It's authentic Los Angeles, California cooking. It's just not authentic Zacatecas-style cooking.
Sure. If you think about Italian immigration and Italian restaurants, you know, if you grew up in the 60s, 70s, and going to an Italian restaurant pretty much meant you were going to an Italian-American restaurant in this country. And then in the, you know, 80s and 90s, that changed. And now we've gotten much more, I don't know, sophisticated. And you go to a Northern Italian restaurant or whatever, and the food is much more like what would be cooked in Italy. But there are, in the meantime, I think people have begun actually appreciating that Italian-American cooking has become its own school of cuisine in a way.
Yeah, no, the Italian restaurants that the food world is the most excited about at the moment in New York City are Teresi and its sister restaurant, Parm. And they are cooking Italian-American food, but sort of in a chefly way. So They will make you a turkey sub or a turkey sandwich for lunch, but it will be the best turkey sandwich you've ever had because they're treating the making of that turkey in a way that the chef will approach it. It's kind of exciting, actually.
Yeah. Are there any cases where an ethnic food has been Americanized and then returned to its place of origin and gotten popular there?
It happens all the time in Korean cooking, for example, that there will, for example, there's a kind of tofu stew called sundobu, which is a kind of jjigae or soupy stew or soupy or stewy soup, whichever you want to look at it, that has, you know, lots of chilies and usually sort of a fish broth and then freshly made tofu. And it's served at the table in, you know, typically a superheated crock. So it's seething like a volcanic crater. It's amazing. And it's sort of always been a dish here, but then it became like faddish, a really popular dish in Los Angeles in the 80s. And it went back and it became a fad in Seoul. Mm. That there's a particular way of cutting short ribs cutting them laterally instead of longitudinally, across the bones. That's on menus all over Seoul as LA galbi, and like the LA will be in Latin letters, while the rest of it will be in Hangul. And even with Italian cooking, I think, I was with a chef friend, Nancy Silverton, who's the chef now of a wonderful restaurant called Mozza in Los Angeles, about 22 years ago in northern Italy. We went to this sort of horrible folkloric restaurant outside Asti in the wine country near Barolo. And among the many bad desserts we had was something they called panna cotta, which was basically, it was like a Bavarian cream with a lot of gelatin and sort of an artificial vanilla taste. And you could have played highlight with this and you could have bounced it. It was a super ball of a dessert. But Nancy is the genius pastry chef of all pastry chefs. So when she got back to California, she tinkered with it. She took out most of the gelatin, and she figured a way to like just barely set the cream so it was like rich and trembling. And she started serving it on her menu, and it spread as a fad first across California, then to New York, then it came back in Italy, and panna cotta is a really popular dessert there. And Italians, of course, will tell you that they've always had panna cotta, but I can tell you they didn't have good panna cotta. That was Nancy.
That's a great story. So then in the 90s, there was the fusion cuisine trend. Remember when, or I guess it was more like the 80s, when the very first, say, French Asian or Californian Asian restaurants were coming about. But in the meantime, fusion's kind of gotten a bad rap somehow. Was there something chefs were getting wrong in those efforts, do you think?
Well, there are a couple stages of fusion. The first stage of fusion was, oddly enough, Japanese chefs cooking French food. They've always had big French cooking schools in Tokyo. And there was a lot of that in L.A. in the earliest 80s, actually, late 70s. Then Wolfgang Puck, you know, who's famous from Spago and probably the first celebrity chef in the country, opened a restaurant called Chinois where he cooked Chinese food a French way. And it was funny. All of his Chinese chefs quit really quickly within the first month because they refused to cook their food in this crazy way that this Austrian chef cooking French food was telling them to do. But it became it became really popular, and the food was really tasty. Now, soon the idea of fusion became people. You know, a lot of chefs go to cooking school, they're reading cookbooks, they're looking at things, they see flavor principles. And they were doing things like making Thai noodles as spaghetti almost without actually having, in Los Angeles, driven the 20 minutes to the restaurant that served actually a really good version of it. But what we're seeing now, people are resisting calling it fusion, but I think it's exciting. I think it's the new big trend in American cuisine, which is chefs from mostly an Asian background, but occasionally from a Latin background, who are exquisitely trained in French cuisine, coming back and cooking their own food, the food of their heritage, the food they grew up eating, but informed by all the technique that they've gotten from working in French restaurants.
For example, what might be a typical dish?
For example, at Momofuku in New York, David Chang, who's probably the most famous of these at the moment, does this dish called bosam. And bosam is a traditional Korean dish that's usually boiled pork belly served with oysters with this particular spicy kimchi made from julienne daikon or radish. And something to wrap it in, usually like a leaf of kimchi. And he's reinterpreted that. He's taken the boiled belly pork and he's made it this delicious spice-rubbed, gochujang-rubbed roast pork shoulder. And you pick pieces of that and you wrap it. And you have these beautiful fresh oysters instead of the little mingy canned ones. And it's a great dish. I'm not sure I absolutely prefer it to the original, but it's certainly an interesting take on it.
I don't know. Doesn't this seem like it's the translation that's happening has more to do with socioeconomics than with taste? I mean, that sounds like you're taking a provincial sort of cooking or everyday kind of cooking and just making it haute cuisine.
Part of it, but that's what haute cuisine is. I mean, almost all the famous dishes began as sort of poor people's dishes that have been elevated. I mean, bouillabaisse was what the fishermen made with the fish he couldn't sell, which is why it was all these sort of bony, gelatinous, ugly fish. And he'd like boil it up with whatever he had. It was this delicious soup. Then it got elevated and saffron started to being a big part of it. Saffron, of course, being the most expensive spice. And they started using grander fish. And you can find them all across the Mediterranean, even using, you know, things like lobster that never would have found it in the original bouillabaisse. But it's a trash fish that's been elevated. I mean, cassoulet is pork and beans with a very specific technique involved. And Korean cooking is about as impoverished a cuisine as you can imagine. I mean, you drive across Korea and you notice that every single bit of flatland where there might possibly be a rice field, there's a rice field. And they eat a lot of invertebrates that appear off every coast in the world, but they're the only ones who eat them, like sea squirts or different kinds of jellyfish or this particularly vile-looking thing called hagfish, which outside of Korean culinary circles is known for being able to produce a 5-gallon bucket of slime within about 30 seconds.
But so what you're saying is that the kind of gradual, raising of sights in food is just something that's always happened?
Sure. I mean when you think about it, a truffle is like a disgusting growth on the root of an oak tree. I'm sure that 500 years ago people used the equivalent of herbicide to get rid of these horrible things. Then somebody tasted it, found out it was delicious, and suddenly it's the most expensive, desirable food in the world. That sturgeon beluga caviar was given away for free in Gold Rush taverns in California in order for the salt to make the miners and the people want to drink more and more and more beer. And it became so desirable that it became thousands and thousands of dollars a pound, and now so desirable that it's essentially extinct of the species.
So we've been talking mostly about food from other cultures that's gotten translated into some kind of American vernacular. Does it work the other way also? I mean, how much American food gets translated abroad? I mean, American food, what, hamburgers, milkshakes? Have you run across any, say, inspired overseas translations of quintessential North American dishes?
Oh, the Royale with cheese? Sorry, Pulp Fiction romance. Pulp Fiction reference. I'm not sure American food translates that well overseas. I mean, it's... You go across the world and it's not like there are America towns in China. But that may be changing. I mean, there is like an America town in Itaewon in Seoul, which is, you know, the neighborhood where the military base is. but it seems to be mostly things like the Hard Rock Cafe and Hooters and Outback Steakhouse. And I don't think anybody's actually trying to interpret American food in an interesting way.
I remember somebody telling me that, you know, in all the major cities around the globe now, there are McDonald's. There's McDonald's in Athens. There's several McDonald's in Barcelona, whatever. Maybe they're not in Paris. I don't know. But
oh, yes, they are.
But what I've heard is that, and I don't know whether this is true, because when I travel, I don't go to McDonald's. But what I've heard is that it's not just the standard McDonald's menu there. Like in Athens, there are McDonald's, the burgers and everything. But then there's also, I don't know, a souvlaki burger or something.
Oh, that's true. And in you know, in Mumbai, when you go to McDonald's, they have the burger is vegetarian for the most part.
Uh-huh. So that seems like a perfect example of American food getting translated for a local foreign audience.
Yeah. There's this cookbook I have in my collection that I sort of love. It's a Mexican cookbook published in English in Calcutta, I think, about 40 or 50 years ago. And it talks about tortillas as being sort of a marvelous thin chapati.
That's pretty good. But, you know, in a way, don't you think that the message of what you've been saying is that that's kind of where it's all headed? I mean, you know, maybe we're going to have layer upon layer of translation and things will have gone back and forth from one continent to another. In the end, we're going to wind up with this sort of global cuisine or mishmash, and it'll be hard even to decode the origins.
Oh, yeah. I mean, already there are like these incredible triple carom shots that I just absolutely love.
Wait, triple for what?
Oh, like carom shots, like in pool, you know, shooting off of three or four different cushions. For example, the kind of taco that is the most popular in Los Angeles now is something called al pastor, which is pork usually that's highly seasoned and cooked on a spit. But al pastor comes from probably from central Mexico, where there was a lot of, Puebla especially, where there was a lot of immigration from the Middle East, especially Lebanon. And al pastor, of course, is, they invented that down there as their version of shawarma. And so, I mean, that's a straight shot, right? Almost.
Yeah.
I mean, you have Lebanon to Puebla to Los Angeles. Or there's this chain of incredibly popular seafood restaurants here that are Vietnamese shrimpers from Houston cooking Cajun-style seafood for a largely Cantonese teenage audience.
It just gets dizzying, doesn't it? So part of me wants to just marvel and admire at this brave new world, and the other part of me worries about what might be lost in all this translation.
Well, you're always hoping that there's this little pocket of cuisine that's staying somehow faithful to itself. And we're lucky now that we have cookbooks and we can actually read, you know, Escoffier, we can read the Delmonico book, and we can know pretty much exactly what people were cooking and eating, you know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago. You know, I mean, there's even Apicius, you know, a very good, very funny cooking manual written in Rome in the first century AD. But sometimes the pockets of purity pop up in weird places. For example, for a long time, the Korean cooking in Los Angeles' Koreatown was more traditional than it was in Seoul, because most of the people who came here left in the 70s when cuisine was a certain way. And in the decades since then, Seoul has gone from being sort of a sleepy provincial capital to being this gigantic international capital, very chic, very forward. And there are ways of making kimchi here that they've forgotten how to do there.
Wow, sort of like sending off a little pod of your civilization on a spaceship to another planet, hoping you can preserve it.
Exactly. Or that's the only real place left in the world to taste Italian cooking as it was practiced, 120 years ago, is in certain neighborhoods of Buenos Aires.
Wow.
Where they've continued to do it as a sign of their culture. I mean, they taste food cooked a certain way, cooked in lard instead of olive oil, for example. And it's a cultural marker, and the cultural marker is important to them, so they keep it that way. Mm. The Basque boarding house cuisine, that you see in going up through California's Central Valley, up through the sort of Mountain West, through Nevada and Idaho, is a kind of Basque cooking that's basically from the 19th century. I mean, you certainly don't see any. I certainly didn't see anything approaching American Basque food, in San Sebastian or Pamplona.
Hmm. Listening to you talk, I realize this is what you are. You're a food translator in a way yourself, aren't you? I mean, how would we ever decode all of this without people like you?
Well, thank you. It's what I try to do. If there's anything other than like describing food that I do, is try to get people to be a little less afraid of their neighbors and to be able to be a little less afraid of their neighbors.
Thank you. That's just great. Thanks.
Thank
okay.
you.